get started. I think there still may be a couple of people who will be wandering in, or maybe they'll be wandering out. And thank you for moving some chairs back there. I appreciate that. My name is Heidi Storrell, and my normal job is to teach at a place called Augustana College. That's in Rock Island, Illinois, along the Mississippi River. It's actually a very beautiful place because the Mississippi is quite beautiful. And so a lot of times I find myself thinking about environmental ethics because in our Mississippi River Valley, for example, we have pretty low air quality in certain areas along the Mississippi River for many of the same reasons that, say, maybe Los Angeles has that kind of problem. It has to do with airflow. It has to do with being located between, in our case, a valley, two valleys, and the air gets trapped there, largely due to the cars and the factories that line the Mississippi River. They're working on improving that, though, so that's a very good thing for us. I also wonder about environmental ethics in my own area because, as it turns out, the Mississippi River, for very good reasons, floods every year. Sometimes the floods are much more significant than other years, but it always floods. And in those years, when those floods are very significant, our water treatment plants have to go overboard. All right, and about 2 years ago, we had a very 100-year flood, they said, although we've been having those 100-year floods more frequently than every 100 years. I've had several in my lifetime, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And so the water treatment plants, they dump a lot of chemicals in order to purify the water. And 2 years ago, it turned out that all of the aquariums in the area were warned to buy their water instead of using any kind of treated water from the tap because the concentration of those chemicals would likely harm the fish. Now, of course, those at home who had fish tanks and didn't read the newspaper or listen to the news suddenly all started losing their fish. So, again, that's an environmental issue. Those are two local environmental issues, and I know very well that here in the Pacific Northwest you also have many environmental issues, some of which we will talk about. As a matter of fact, think of Golden Village, right? It has just a few environmental issues. Okay. And you probably know much more about them than I do. I know a little bit. I've been trying to accumulate some information about that, and I'm not quite sure I can come up with a consistent story yet about what's going on over there. So some nights, I've only been here a week. This is my first time. Some nights I'm quite nervous about being here, and other nights I think, oh, you know, I can practically drink the water out of the creek. But I haven't quite done that yet. So, in any case, we're here to talk about environmental ethics. And if you have questions along the way, if you have your own environmental issues that you think might pertain to some of the things that we're talking about, please share those with us. All right, so we're going to begin with this question. And that question is, what is or should be our relationship to nature? That's a good basic kind of question for us to consider and to get started with. What does Genesis say? The book of Genesis. What does it say?
Subdue.
Okay, to subdue nature. So one view is actually that we should have or do have dominions over the earth. Okay, and we have a kind of dominance over the earth. What's the other story? There's not just one story in Genesis if you read the creation accounts carefully. Right, the caretaker story. The story of stewardship. All right, so in our history, we actually have two stories that answer that very question. The problem is, when we answer that question, what should be our relationship to nature, is this. All sentient creatures, just put it that way, all sentient creatures are inherently valuable. All sentient creatures are inherently valuable. So the million-dollar question is, what does sentient mean? Sentient means something to do with the head. It's cognitive, but that's still a little bit too sophisticated. Pain feeling. All pain feeling creatures. So they opened up the door a little bit, these sentientists did. Peter Singer is one of their primary spokesmen. I don't know if you read him, but Peter Singer is one of the primary advocates of this position, still today. And so what they did is they said, well, you know, it can't just be humans that count environmentally speaking and have that inherent value. It can't just be human decision making, but those whales and those dolphins and all those fish and those pelicans, right, they all count too. So now, on Norma Wien's little chart, we have the top half being what is most important. All right, so that's a little better. All right, still incomplete, and we'll see why as we go on. That first claim, then, of the sentientist position leads to a second one. And that second claim, then, is that we have an obligation or a duty to preserve some non-human, this is bad grammar, non-humanly relevant environments. So if there is a little crayfish, right, that really we don't eat, okay, we don't find particularly aesthetically pleasing, okay, we don't use it for sports in any sort of way, okay, we have no use for this little thing, all right? Nevertheless, though, if it feels pain, and some of my biologist friends say it could very well feel pain, then whatever environment it needs in order to survive is one that we have a duty to protect. So it does nothing for our interests, but nevertheless, because it is sentient, it has some rights. You know, they don't use the term rights, but it has some rights. All right? Okay, we'll come back to that. We'll see why that's problematic in just a second. But I want to go to the egocentric view. The egocentric view, or echo, sorry, a big difference, echocentric view is this one. Right? It's the stewardship view. It says it's not humans that are the center of things, but it is everything. Okay? It is everything. Ecology here is a very broad term. It's actually, in many of the best forms of this literature, a spiritual term, and we'll talk about that. All right? So when we talk about ecocentric views in environmental ethics, we're talking about all of this. Okay, we can't talk about the animals and the humans and the sentient kinds of creatures without talking about their interconnections with living vegetation and with clay and humus and soil. Okay, so the whole thing counts. If we lose this, we lose everything. So how can we not have an interest in that? On this particular view, on this caretaker view, on this more stewardship-based view, okay, think of that other story in Genesis. What we have is what has come to be known as the deep ecology movement. Anybody ever hear that terminology before? Okay, it's the deep ecology movement. This is the most serious green position. All right, there is no doubt that this is most serious. And one of the things that I want to look at today is just what it demands of us. I am willing to bet that none of us really are here, all right? None of us are here yet. We might want to be there, but we're not there, all right? Which means we're not here. It probably means we're somewhere in between, all right? But that's one of the things I want us to think about. What exactly are or should be our responsibilities to the ecocentric world that we live in? And again, think of that in terms of a being, if I use that term from previous classes that I've had. Or think of it in terms of a responsibility to that which is. All right? What is that which is? It's far greater than any of us. Okay? And it's even far greater than that, as we will continue to see. All right. So let me do what I do next in all of these little presentations that I have. And give you a couple of facts. I like to tell facts, I like to share facts, I like to share knowledge, and then I like to tell stories as well, because I think it's that combination of the subjective and the objective, the certain and the uncertain, the knowledge and what I sometimes call wisdom, that will get us to the right spot. It'll lead us away from these kinds of dichotomies. All right? Okay, so here's just a couple of facts. These come from an internet source which is very highly regarded. It's called ecofuture.org. They give you almost a daily update on the status of how we're doing here in the United States regarding environmental issues. All right, so here's what I pulled actually in May 6th of this year. At least most of the information comes from May 6th. Some of it they hadn't updated yet. So the rise in per capita consumption in the United States in the last 20 years was 45%. Okay, so we're consuming 45% more than what we did just 20 years ago. The decrease in quality of life in that same time period was 51%. So one of the things that we're going to see, especially as we move over to this side, is that there is a direct correlation between consumption and quality of life. Every time in every country, when they have this kind of data, if consumption goes up, quality of life goes down. Okay? Might be counterintuitive at first glance, right? Prima facie counterintuitive. But very quickly, if you think about that, it makes some sense, right? This is our addiction to our materialistic ways of life. And oil is just one example of that. All right, so a little bit more. This has an impact on our life. Compared to their parents in 1950, people in the United States own twice as many cars and drive three times as far in the cars that they own. All right, so again, a little bit of our lifestyle, even more starkly. The American parents spend 40% less time with their children now than they did in 1965. 40% less time. I'll have more information on just what that means in a second. The percentage of college freshmen who report thinking it essential to be well off financially in 1967 was 44%. In 1997, it was 86%. Money matters. Money matters. Yet, the percentage of college freshmen who reported thinking it essential to develop a philosophy of life, a kind of spirituality about their existence, in 1967, it was 83%. For 1997, it was 39%. Right? So what's going on there in those young minds? A little bit more. I have about 20 of these facts. Some of them are longer, some of them are shorter. Quality of life issue. The amount of time the average American will spend watching TV commercials as of 2009 is one entire year of their life. All right, so all those irritating Super Bowl commercials that you might see, right? They're eating up one entire year of their life. All right. Percentage of American teenage girls, I almost have one of these, I'm not quite there yet, who report store hopping as a favorite activity, 93%. Quality of life. Year in which the number of shopping centers in the United States surpassed the number of high schools, 1987. So how are we spending our money? Quality of life. Average time spent shopping over a course of a week, 6 hours. This is including grocery shopping, all right? Time spent playing with children per week, 40 minutes. Oh. Now, that is pure time spent playing with children, not, you know, helping them wash or getting their meals ready or helping them with their homework. Doesn't even count that time. It counts pure play time, 40 minutes. That's pretty stunning. Quality of life. The waste generated each year in the United States would fill a convoy of 10-ton garbage trucks over halfway to the moon. That would be 145,000 miles, give or take a few. That's a lot of garbage. By the time a baby born in the United States reaches age 75, he or she will have produced 52 tons of garbage, consumed 43 million gallons of water, and used 3,400 barrels of oil. A baby. One baby. That lives to 75 in the United States. For packaging, cans, bottles, cartons, things like that, for packaging alone in the United States, that takes up 50% of the paper that we use, 75% of the glass that we use, 40% of the aluminum that we use, and 30% of our plastics for packaging alone. If you've ever traveled outside of the United States, you'll know that they deal with packaging very differently than we do. Okay, across the board. And let's see, this one, I can't believe, I double-checked it. Each year they report the same thing. Amount of motor oil sent to landfills or poured down drains in the United States each year, 180 million gallons. The equivalent of 16 Exxon Valdez spills. Mm. All right? So all those oil changes, right? For all those cars, they add up. Where do they go? All right? Some of that's recycled, but not as much as we should. All right, percentage of Americans who say they have achieved the American dream, quality of life. For those earning less than $15,000 a year, right? Not much, 5% have achieved the American dream. For those that are earning more than $50,000, and by today's standards, not much, 6% have achieved the American dream. Okay, not much of a difference. The amount of energy used by one American, me, is equivalent to that used by 3 Japanese, 6 Mexicans, 14 Chinese people, 38 Indians from India, 168 Bengalis, and this one's unbelievable. I use the equivalent amount of energy as 531 Ethiopians. Wow. Wow. So do we have an environmental crisis in this country? What is our relationship to the environment? And what should it be? Right? That's why we're here. Percentage of fossil fuel used annually that is consumed by the United States, 25%. Okay, that's how much oil we use. 25% of all that is produced worldwide in each year. Percentage of humans who own a car. Anybody want to take a guess on this one?
84%.
Of all humans.
Oh, humans, sorry.
Percentage of all humans worldwide.
5%.
Not bad. 5 to 10, very good. 8% as of last year. All right, so that's why we use 25% of the world's oil. Okay, just a few more. This is some of the things that Norma Lean talked about this morning. In the last 200 years, he has very specific data about forests, if you were at that session. The United States has lost 50% of its wetlands, 90% of the northwestern old-growth forests, 99% of its tall grass prairies, and up to 500 species of native plants and animals, with another 9,000 now at risk. Minerals due to run out in 50 years, copper, lead, mercury, nickel, tin, and zinc. That'll change our lifestyle. Amount of rural land in the United States turned over to development every day. 9 square miles every day in the United States. And this is even more astounding. Number of acres we blacktop each year here in the United States is equivalent to the state of Delaware.
Every
year? Just pave it. Every year. Again, this was part of what Norma Lean was talking about this morning when he said we currently have 310 million people in the United States. In another 40 years, we'll be well over 400 million. They need roads, right? They need shopping centers. That's why we blacktop. All right, I've got 3 more. In the United States, we use 250 gallons of oil equivalent per person each year. All right? Europeans use half that amount. Of course, their oil is far more expensive than our oil. Most Europeans produce less than half the waste per person as the average American. They got that recycling down, let me tell you. And lastly, the possibility that all the world's people could live as Americans? Anybody want to take a guess at that?
Zero.
All right, so we do have an environmental crisis. Environmental ethics should be on the top of all of our lists, at least near the top, if not at the top of all of our lists. So let's turn to these 3 positions. Let me get rid of this one very quickly. What's the problem with sentientism? Anybody want to take a guess? Why isn't it not going to work?
Because it doesn't improve to produce life.
Okay, exactly. The way that the harshest critics of this position put it is they say the sentientist position, even though it takes account of both of these, as you say, it doesn't take account of that. So the sentientist position is actually equivalent to a kind of racism or a kind of sexism because it privileges its own kind, right? Those pain-feeling creatures, right? So what good is that going to do us? So many people say this view is inherently biased. We've got to go that way or this way. and you'd be surprised that it's not quite an even divide.
All right, just a quick question. What happened? You said that was the 60s, so was that like a wave of the time, or what happened?
I think it was, I mean, think about what happened in the 40s and the 50s, mm-hmm. okay? Especially in this country. I mean, we were at the peak of production, of hope, the future was open, you know, a real kind of what is sometimes called cowboy ethics had taken hold. I mean, I can remember, you know, well, I can see pictures of these huge cars that people were purchasing, maybe two of them, you know, the houses kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So, I mean, that was the American dream, all right? That was the 50s. The sentientist position broke away from that, so started the movement in the right direction, right? So they broke away from that and included other species, other higher level species, but didn't go as far as the stewardship movement, the caretaker movement, which is more holistic, which is taking the entire picture into view. Yeah. And there were some proponents of this view in the 60s, but they weren't the majority position. Yeah, so we have to look at that past, where we came from. All right, so let's go back to this. You know, I always think to myself, I don't have to spend much time on this, because how could anybody still believe it, right? How could anyone still believe it? But then what happened recently when the Obama administration put a moratorium on all deep well drilling in the Gulf? Do you remember that happened? 6-month moratorium? What happened to that?
It was overturned.
It was overturned.
His ratings plummeted.
It was, pardon?
His ratings plummeted.
Yeah, his ratings plummeted, all right. But it was overturned by a federal judge because there are 33 deep wells in the Gulf. Okay, 33 of the kind that didn't work out so well for BP, all right? Obama said, we got to see what's going wrong here. We've got to have some kind of backup plan. The federal judge said that the Obama legislation was too broad and didn't deal with enough specific facts. All right, so they overturned it, all right? That's why this still exists. Okay, this cowboy ethics mentality still exists. And so that's why we have to say just a little bit more about it. All right, what is this argument based on? Okay, what kind of arguments might the libertarians give? Here's the leading argument. Some of you may be familiar with this old terminology. It's called the tragedy of the commons. It goes all the way back to the 1600s, and a person by the name of John Locke. John Locke was very influential as a social political thinker in the formulation of our own constitution. All right, so there's a kind of history there. And what does the tragedy of the commons say? Can you say it?
I'm not sure I can, but it comes from the idea that there were areas where everyone was free to let their animals graze, and then it all got eaten up and nobody's animals could live.
Exactly. So again, picking up on something that a number of folks talked about this week, what we have is we have the public land, private land debate settled, at least if you are in this camp. So let's look at the data, says somebody like Narveson. Public land, you could take the overgrazed pasture, but let's bring it up to date a little bit for us. Think about your favorite public restrooms, right? That's public. How good are those restrooms a lot of times? They're not so good, right? We don't take care of the common. You can think of pools, you can think of public parks. One of the things that my daughter and I were talking about today as we were walking out to Monkey Bear Falls was, you know what, we haven't seen any litter on the trails here. All right, but this isn't your normal common up here, is it? It's a common that's governed by that kind of model. But if you go walking in public parks, which we do a lot, even Yellowstone, right, these national treasures, there's trash all over the place. People don't stay on the trails. So the libertarians say, you know, this doesn't work. This will be abused. So privatize. Privatize. As a matter of fact, the strongest libertarians, again, this person named Narveson, who is sort of the model of this, he says everything ought to be privatized, okay, including Yellowstone, because then it will appropriately be cared for. And he gives you case after case after case. He says, look at your farmer. Your farmer, single owner farmer, is not going to overgraze his pasture. He's going to take care of his soybean fields or his corn fields or his wheat fields. All right? But that's because it's private. If you go public, it's hopeless. It'll be ruined. That is the tragedy of the commons. So what if a problem arises? Then what if the farmer down the road has a stream that runs through your land as well, and he dumps dioxins into the stream, right? And your cattle drink the water out of the stream, and they die. Okay, so there you have a problem, right? Clearly you have a problem. How do you deal with that problem? Two ways. Literally, you sue, okay? Because that threat of being sued by your neighbor on this view will keep private property owners responsible. Okay, so it's not that you actually have to sue. Only in extreme cases would you have to sue, because it has this deterrent effect. For those of you who were there last night, we talked about deterrence a lot, right? So there's the deterrent effect in this litigious society of ours, so that we don't have to worry, because we're being responsible because that threat's hanging over us. But if that doesn't work, right, if you don't like the sue option, you can always negotiate. That's what they did in the Gulf of Mexico. What did they do, what did BP do 3 days after they realized the enormity of their situation? They were swift. What did they do? Anybody remember?
They were conscientious.
Yeah. So the fishermen, they weren't fisheries because it's a lot of small family fishermen, so the fishermen and the oyster beds and some of the hotels who had beaches along the area that looked like it was going to turn into sludge, BP sent out representatives to those individuals and made them a deal. Okay, they negotiated with them. And they said, we'll give you, no questions asked, a check for $5,000, all right, if you agree not to sue us. Do you remember reading about this? Oh, yeah. And so these are very, very poor people, right? They're not wealthy people who are living in those areas. Of course not. All right? We learned that from Katrina. We didn't know it before. So $5,000 is an enormous amount of money. It's like winning the lottery, except for they can't sue. All right? So Obama actually intervened, and he told BP, get out of here. Don't make this deal. All right? So that offer is no longer on the table. But notice, given this position, dominion over the earth, right, self-interest driven, of course that's going to be a negotiation made. And it wasn't. Fortunately, to Obama's credit, he did stop it. Okay, two more things. Here's something that you always hear. What's it worth to you? All right? What's the environment actually worth to you? What this position does is it allows us to quantify our environmental values, right? So you like your fresh water, okay? You like clean streams in your local neighborhoods, all right? So what's that worth to you? Is that worth, for example, giving up golf? Because golfing, actually, and the way that they have to manicure their greens is one of the largest small stream polluters that exists in the United States. So, again, driven by human interest, if it's worth to you to give up the game, literally, right, then you can have your clean water. But a lot of people say, oh, it can't be that bad. You know, I don't golf very often, so I'm only having a little bit of an impact. So we rationalize our way out of it. So too with oil, right, as we've seen from the statistics that I read. So what's it worth to you? Big question. All right, fourth point that they make. Fourth point that they make is a huge one, especially given I erased it, the kind of libertarian political theory that's in the background here. And it is keep government out. Okay? Keep government out. As a matter of fact, my person, Narveson, who I like to read on this only so that I can know what they're thinking, says this. This is a direct quote. No force or fraud except to protect citizens from force or fraud. Okay, we want no regulations whatsoever except for protection against force and fraud. He goes on to say, this is a conclusion, it is inherently wrong-headed to empower a public lawmaking body with the power to make laws requiring all to conform. So, hands off, what we have is a complete deregulation, you know that term, right? A complete deregulation of the free market. Okay, what heavy duty political terminology there is there, right? Deregulation of the free market. Because if it's private and nothing intervenes from the government, we're going to be more responsible. Like that farmer who's not going to overgraze his land. So we wouldn't have had the mess in the Gulf of Mexico if it weren't for all of the deregulation that occurred in the past decade. All right? But that's where we are. That's where we are on all sorts of things, not just oil. All right? Okay, let me give you, I'll leave it at that. Let's take a look at the brighter side of things. Keeping an eye on time. What about this as an alternative? This is a quickly growing movement, but as those facts should have demonstrated, it does require a significant life change on our part. All right? It really does. From, you know, the plastic that I have in the soles of my shoes, right? All the way up to this thing that I'm wearing in my hair, which also has elastic in it. Those are all petroleum products, right? So it does require a massive change. Should we, you know, how economically, what kinds of amends should we make if I'm traveling from Illinois all the way to Holby? I mean, think about the consumption of fuel, all right? So how do we change our lives? Yeah, I have to get you. Well, in this particular movement, let me show you a couple of things that they say. I'll give you a little bit of background, and we're going to take a look at two intuitions they have. Notice they call them intuitions. They don't call them rights and duties and obligations. They're intuitions. All right? And then we're going to take a look at a direct way of comparing these two, and then we'll hopefully end on a positive note. So here's the history. Arne Nest, Aldo Leopold, Rachel Carson, if you know those names, they were some of the first consistent thinkers of this kind of deep ecology movement. As I mentioned earlier, there's also a large philosophical or spiritual, reflective, meditative component to this particular kind of movement. So it's not just about a cost-benefit analysis and politics, but it's about religion as well. What life should I lead? Here's a slogan that comes from some of the leading thinkers on this. Simple in means, rich in ends. Simple in means, rich in ends. So instead of having five shoes, you have one. All right? And you make them canvas. Right? All right? So simple in means, rich in ends. Low consumption, high fulfillment. Right? Think back to that first fact that I gave you, where we now consume 45% more, but we're 51% less happy. Right? That's exactly what this debate is all about. Here, it's consume, 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 motivated by maximizing self-interest. All right? Here, it's simplicity. These folks say what's happening over here is that there is a mask that we've put on. Okay? If you get really sophisticated, it's a mask of inauthenticity. It is a mask of inauthenticity. So because of the PR job, because of advertising, because of that year's worth of commercial that we see, right, we're bombarded with the latest fads, the latest styles. I need a new computer. I know I just got one last year, but this one is so much quicker. Same way with cell phones, right? I have to buy the most efficient stuff, but next year it'll be even more efficient, so I got to buy even more, right? There is an inauthenticity to that. And the deep ecologists say, spiritually again, reflectively, meditatively, we got to think about what we're doing in our lives. We may think that we're going green by buying all of these more efficient kinds of appliances. You know, the Obama administration, earlier this year, was it in March and April? Yeah, something like that. If you buy these high efficiency appliances, then you get a lot of savings in the end. I forget exactly what that deal was. I actually tried to partake of that. I remember I had to drive my husband to work, and then I had to drive my kids to their school. I didn't teach actually until 10, and so naively I went to Sears thinking I can buy a new dishwasher and get this bargain, right? So I get to Sears, and there are already 50 people in front of me, and all of them, no offense intended, all of them were retired. And so I thought, how in the world is this fair to those of us who have families, who have a job, and we can't get in line? And in the state of Illinois, if you wanted to partake of this, because we have this huge thing called Chicago in our state, the funds that were given to the state of Illinois were to run out by, they estimated, around 11 o'clock. So even if I would skip my class on that particular day in order to be environmentally responsible, right, I would not have made it through the line because it took about 20 minutes per person and there were 50 people ahead of me. So I had no chance to be green, right? But would that really have been green? If I buy a new, more efficient appliance, right, consume more plastic, right, when my old machine works fine, maybe I should just wash less frequently. Maybe I should wear my shirts twice or my socks twice. All right? So there you go. The math of inauthenticity, there are volumes and volumes and volumes written on this by these thinkers. All right? So that's one point I wanted to make. Second point that I wanted to make is they talk about being... Actually, it's not put that way. Some of them are very detailed. They talk about being in being. Small b, big b. Alright? So that's their slogan, or at least some of their slogans, for this particular idea. We are human beings, okay, but we get a little b. We're not going to get the big b that's over here. But our being is embodied, embedded in that which is. There's the spiritual side of that, right? We are gods, right? We are a part of God, but so are all of the other aspects of his creation, right? So I earlier this week I asked the question, you know, is our body sacred? But I shouldn't have asked just that question, because on the deep ecology view, especially on some of the most radical versions of this, and there are many groups, religious groups, who have very radical versions of this. They say this, right, the compost out there, it's sacred too. You cannot write it off. It might not be as sacred as you, but it is sacred too. It needs to be respected in certain sorts of ways. You can't just count it out. All right, so it's a very, here's another big word, it is a very holistic view. It involves a holism. Right. Okay. Let's see. Maybe two more things, and then I want to put a final kind of chart on the board. The really interesting thing about the ecocentric view is that, in an interesting spiritual sort of way, it is universal. It's universalistic. I have a very, very good friend who's a Buddhist. All right. And before I actually seriously started thinking about environmental ethics, I actually, my area of specialization is in clinical ethics and medical ethics. Boy, there's a lot of waste there. Wow. And talk about the environmental waste. It's unbelievable. So that sort of led me to think more broadly about what's happening there in the hospitals. But in any case, I have a friend who I have known now for nearly 20 years. She's a Buddhist. She was born and raised in Sri Lanka, and she got a PhD in religious studies from Northwestern, and she now teaches in the area where I work, and her area again is Buddhism. And so she said, probably the second year that I knew her, and I didn't know her very well at that point, she said, well, I'm thinking about getting my driver's license. Ha! Think about this. This is a woman who's 2 years older than I am, all right? She's thinking about getting a driver's license. She's lived in the United States for the past, at that point, probably 10, 12 years. She's married to an American, and she's thinking about getting a driver's license. She doesn't have a driver's license. What's wrong with her, right? So I say, okay, so what's the problem? And, you know, very seriously, she says, well, somehow I have to make amends for this, all right? I have to make amends because have you ever looked at the grate on the front of a car? Have you ever seen all the insects and butterflies and feathers, right? Let alone the stuff that you might run over on the road. She's dead serious. This is not funny. She was thinking about getting the car because she had a baby, okay? And her husband couldn't drive the car and drive the child to all of the appointments that he had. So she had to help out. So this put her in a moral dilemma. How do I make up for the fact that I'm going to be killing all of these things down here, right? And those things, think Buddhism, are a part of something much more powerful, much richer spiritually. All right? So that's very interesting because Buddhism has that kind of thought. Hinduism has that kind of thought. There are many aspects of Christianity that have had that kind of thought, going all the way back to Hildegard von Bingen. Anybody ever hear of Hildegard von Bingen? She was somebody who had this view when she was writing many hundreds of years ago. Right? So very interesting. We've got about 5 minutes left. I want to leave you with one thought and then a couple of principles. All right? Is that okay?
Okay.
All right. So how do I put all of this into a nutshell? I do this for my class, and they typically find it pretty helpful, so I thought I'd share this with you. I've got a little chart. And so we have the anthropocentric or dominion, dominant kind of worldview, and then we have the caretaker or stewardship kind of worldview. And if we think about that, and contrast it, I'll let you decide where it is that we are or should be. So there are a couple of things that we have to consider. One is our relation to nature or with nature. So that's our lead question. We have to think about our view of progress, right? Progress is good, right? I mean, that's one of our mainstays, main values. The role of resources. What is that oil? What's the role of that oil? What's the role of that water? What's the role of those trees? All right. Not only the role of resources anymore, we also have to consider how those resources are used. So what's the role of technology? Right? We can only build more ecologically sound refineries, then we're off the hook. We've made some amends, perhaps. Okay, economics in our society always plays a role, and we've got to talk about community, because it isn't just about us, right? We already know that. It's about self and other. It's about being in or with beings, right? So we've got to talk about community. All right, so on the dominion point of view, on the anthropocentric point of view, the relationship with nature is obviously one of dominance. We've already seen that. The view of progress, this will sound familiar, is one of unlimited growth. You've heard that, right? Unlimited growth. The view of resources is one of consumption, hence our consumerist society. The role of technology is one of salvation. Technology is going to save us. How many times have you heard that? In medicine, you know, technology is going to save us. Computers are going to save us. They're going to make us better people. They're going to give us a global village. All right? In terms of economics, I just said it, consumerism, it is healthy to buy. To get out of this recession, you know, a lot of people are saving, but that's not really going to help us. We actually should be spending to get us out of the recession. But that isn't that what got us into trouble in the first place? Right? So this is not an economics class, I'm going to let that go. Community. This one may surprise you. The community view is ultimately global. We're going to privatize, but we're going to go global with that, right? If we can only get people in Ethiopia and in India and in China and in Russia to privatize, then it'll be better, all right? So it's a global community. There's a single standard. All right, stewardship model, the ecocentric model, the caretaker model, that other story in Genesis. Relationship to nature is one of harmony. Again, that idea of being, sometimes it's with, sometimes it's in being. Okay? You can't cut off your foot and say that you're doing better. It's the whole system. Okay? The view of progress is one of simplicity. Low consumption, high fulfillment. That's not complicated. It really isn't complicated. That's why that American dream is not so different between those who are earning under $15,000 a year, which is nothing, right? That's way below the poverty level, and those who are earning more than $50,000. Like, there's something askew there. It's simplicity that we need. In terms of the role of resources, here's a word we don't hear much anymore. Preservation. Leopold, although Leopold talked about that a lot. Preservation. It doesn't mean, Norma Lee, my colleague, and I talked about this. He was indicating in this morning session with respect to forests that, you know, we're doing better. And we are doing better. We have more trees now. But those trees are planted in neat and tidy little rows, and they're harvested every 50 years, and they don't encourage biodiversity because the undergrowth is so impoverished. All right? So, yeah, we're doing better because we have more trees, but we don't have the proper idea of resources because that model, that Forest Service model, I used to work for the Forest Service, actually, so I know a little bit about this as well. That Forest Service model is still about logging those trees every 50 years on a rotating cycle. You cannot have a well-established ecosystem if it's completely destroyed every 50 years. All right, so preservation. All right, preservation. The role of technology. This is an interesting one. It is our potential demise. Potential demise. All right, so those computers which make our lives easier, do they really? Make your life easier? How about that BlackBerry? How many of you have a BlackBerry? Or whatever the Apple equivalent is. Make your life easier?
In some ways, yeah.
I won't circle mask about inauthenticity because we don't have it here anymore. But I actually took the plunge. I got a BlackBerry. I got a BlackBerry because of this thing that I do in Houston. I run a research internship at the Texas Medical Center. All right, and I have students down there, and, you know, I feel that I have to care for these students. And the only way that they can contact me when I'm down there, and they're scattered throughout the medical center, and it's the size of Manhattan, so it's a huge medical center. If they have to get in touch with me quickly, then I don't, you know, have my computer on me, so they can email me, they can call me, and I'm ready to go. You know, but I don't just use that BlackBerry when I'm in Houston. And so I check it because I want to see what emails I have. It's an addiction. It is an addiction. Uh-huh. You know, why do I have to check those emails? I haven't checked them for the past week, and you know what? I don't care. I did not remember that. I'm only thinking today, I can't wait to push that delete button, delete, 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 for all those messages that are going to line up. Actually, what will happen first is that my mailbox in my office will not be able to handle the information, so I won't be able to access it anyway. But, you know, then people on the other end are going to get really, really nervous because she's not responding. Right? So what's wrong with her? She's being irresponsible. So see, this is the life we lead. There's something odd about it. And if you know anything about these, you know, computer viruses and how they could crash our entire way of being just like that, there are people working on those, and they're not that tough. They're actually not that tough. So if we were to be hit by one of those viruses, wow, that might be our demise. All right, so the ecocentrists say, we've got to think about that. The stewardship people say, simplicity, remember simplicity, that's where we need to be. Okay, consumerism, well, it is use and reuse. in terms of economics, use and reuse. Narveson, our friend over here, he says it is sheer stupidity to recycle. He says all of the U.S. garbage can actually be put in a 17-mile, square mile, a certain depth pit located somewhere on the East Coast. Okay, so we don't have to recycle, because if we're paving over the state of Delaware every year, why don't we just pave over our garbage? Right? So you don't have to recycle. It's a waste of time right here, right now. That might change in the future, he says, but right now, we're spending all these resources on something that we could be expending them on, which would be better. Yeah, it's unbelievable. If you want some citations for Narveson just for fun at some point, I'll be happy to give them to you. Okay, community. Community is local. All right? Global village, it's unsustainable, according to the stewardship model. All right? Now think about that. If you think about Wendell Berry, anybody read Wendell Berry? Okay, he's all about that. Okay, he's a living example of this. There are others as well. All right, but the idea here is to go local. Okay, nurture your communities. Nurture. You know what a world this would be. What a nation this would be if we had little Holden communities everywhere. Right, Holden villages. I actually had the very great privilege when I was in my early 20s, to be a part of a village that was something like this over in Switzerland. It was part of the Waldorf school movement. Anybody ever hear of Camp Hill, all of that kind of stuff? Well, that's been very big in Europe, okay? That is certainly a community that taps into the spiritual nature of this caretaker model. And so way back when I was in my 20s, I was able to live there in that community. They were a community of about 150 permanent people, and they were entirely self-sustaining, and they had surplus products which they would take into Geneva, and if an emergency arose or if they needed to buy a new cow, they could do it. Now, why can't we have more of those? It's a different world. But again, remember the question that I asked. What does it mean to be green? Means a radical change in lifestyle. And so the question for us today, as we're over time and about to end, is, how far do we want to go? If you think again about that continuum from here through the sentientist to the caretaker, all right, where would you draw your existence line? Would it be there? Would it be there? Would it be there? And how far are you willing to go? Are you willing to give up that game of golf in order to have clean water?
Except if you give up that game of golf, you still won't have clean water because the thousands of others that are still playing golf.
Right, right. And so that's why it has to be a slow movement. It has to be a growing movement. So why don't we start a Holden village in the Quad Cities? Why don't we do that? We have very beautiful places in the Quad Cities. Why don't we start a village like this in the Quad Cities?
Community with no golf courses.
Sure. Sure.
Let's just talk about that for a second. So let's say you have 500 people, which is roughly what's here, that you needed to grow the food or trade with other communities like that,
mm-hmm. Right.
Locally,
mm-hmm.
in order to feed your group and perish the thought you got sick and you didn't have health insurance, maybe the
right.
national one will take care
but
of
it. But we would have the village doctor, and the village doctor would help.
Yeah.
And if we had more healthy lifestyles, maybe we wouldn't have some of the obesities or diabetes problems that we do have.
That's true.
So
that's definitely true. But infectious disease might still be a problem.
That could still be an issue.
Yes.
Right.
So anyway, how many acres do you need, and how much would it cost to buy it, and where would you come up with that with your simple lifestyle if somebody didn't bestow upon you a grant to say, to have that many acres to support 500 people, you would need $3 million, I think, to buy the land?
Yeah. Although
the transition troubles me. I don't know how you get there.
Right, and it has to be slow. slow, and it has to be thoughtful. But I think especially it has to be slow, right? But think about, I have a farmer, actually, this is unbelievable. You probably know the names better than I do, Jean. But we have a farmer who, in the Quad Cities, has a farm that he now lets Augustana students grow crops in that farm, all organically and biodynamically, and then that food is now used in our food service. All right. So, you know, amongst us all, right, or those in our community, there is land. It doesn't take that much land. We don't need large communities. And it only takes one individual like this farmer that I have in mind who has 30, 40 acres to sustain, to sustain a community. So you start small and you build up.
You get 500 people spread out 40 acres.
Why don't we start with 20 people?
You have to be careful with your buildup because that's our problem in this country. Is build, grow.
So start with 20.
I mean, but we the end result is not to be the biggest.
Right.
We don't need to be the biggest.
Right. And we do have religious communities. Again, we have a number of religious communities in our area, northern Iowa and in southern Wisconsin, where, you know, they are communities. They are very low consumption, high quality of life communities. There is a community that makes, of actually monks, New Millery, that makes caskets, among other things, and they are entirely self-sustaining, just like that village that I was in, all right? And they have quite a few people. There's another bread-making community. There is a caramel-making community. Very low maintenance, but very high output. Right? In the right sort of way. So we have those communities. Why don't we make those our own?
Yeah. Don't we have the trouble with convincing people that that is the lifestyle they want to achieve rather than consumerism?
Yeah.
And some people would not want that kind of lifestyle, so we really have to work
Right. Exactly right. It's one, and Wendell Berry is, you know, the best at I think making that particular case in the contemporary literature. It is one-on-one, it's realistic, and you know, it's simple. He says in one particularly poignant passage, he says, you know, these hands can care for 23 cows. That's it. Right? They can't care for more. If they care for more, that mask of inauthenticity gets placed on. Alright? So, again, just to share that sentence has gotten some of my students to think about what exactly that means. You know, some of them come from, we live in an agricultural area, and some of them come from huge, you know, cattle farms, feedlot farms. And they're thinking, well, you know, we have about, oh, maybe 200 cattle. And he's saying 23? And all that that entails, you know, all that that entails. All right.
Just curious, how close would this be to an Amish community taking out the religious part of it, I guess?
Not necessarily taking out the religious part of it, and very close.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Very close. Yeah, very close. Yes.
I think we have to keep in the religious part of it.
I do too.
Well, I just mean you don't have to adopt being an Amish person to be an Amish community like this.
Yeah, let's put it this way. I think there has to be a spiritual or a, you know, a meditative, a philosophy of life component to it. It can't, you have to have that because that's what that holism involves. That's what that being in being means. So I think you have to have that. I think probably our best examples of successful communities right now, ones who sort of have an idea about how it works, are communities that have that spiritual component. Because they know what community means, right? They've moved away from the kind of cowboy ethics or rugged individualism that characterizes what Augustine writes. They're not there. They're their heads are someone else. All right, well, we're way past supper time. So.